Hello, welcome. Welcome to the Ann Arbor District Library and a wonderful evening with Rachel Dworskin. Rachel is an Ann Arbor native and a former student at Community High. She graduated from Columbia University. In 1994, Rachel moved to Beijing and worked as a PR consultant and later star in a popular and hugely successful Chinese soap opera, watched eagerly by an estimated 600 million people. Currently, Rachel is the associate poetry editor of Agni Magazine and an artist in residence at Teachers and Writers. She teaches creative writing at New York University. Her novel, Aisha's English, is forthcoming this year, 2008. So let's get started.
Thank you for the generous introduction, and thank you guys for showing up and for having me. It's, of course, very nice to be home in Ann Arbor. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Foreign Babes in Beijing and a little bit about Beijing and Chinese ideas about Western girls and other things that interest me, Chinese reality TV. And then I will be happy to take any and all questions. So for the Chinese soap opera Foreign Babes in Beijing, from which I borrowed the title for my book, gave me two unique opportunities. One was to be an American temptress and homewrecker who seduces a married Chinese man, falls in love with him, and then sacrifices everything for true love when she agrees to marry him. The other, slightly less titillating but ultimately more fulfilling, was to have a kind of dual perspective on the fraught romance between China and the West. On the one hand, during my life in Beijing, I was living the life of a foreign babe, if you can accept that terminology. And on the other hand, I was playing the Chinese idea of that life on national television. So I had an opportunity to chart the parallel courses of those two lives and those two versions of my life, and to consider not only how some of Beijing's backstage worlds work, but also how China thinks about America, and in particular American women. And thankfully, it also made me think carefully about why China thinks about America and American women the way it does. So just a little bit of background. Foreign Babes in Beijing was produced by the Beijing TV studio in 1995 as a wannabe sequel to the hit show Beijinger in New York. I don't know how many of you saw that show. But that was about a Chinese guy who travels to New York and experiences the many horrors of life in the West. So, in a sense, Foreign Babes in Beijing was a sort of optimistic reconfiguring in the sense that the babes themselves, who were two American girls, moved to Beijing and China was sort of getting the West's best assets. The show itself was about two sexy Western women falling in love with China and Chinese men, virile and macho Chinese men, unlike the ones we usually see depicted by Hollywood. I was starring, ludicrously, in Foreign Babes as Jessie, the bad girl of the good girl, bad girl duo. And my involvement in the soap went something like this. I was at a party and some young, handsome Chinese guy said to me, "You're white, do you want to be in my friend's soap opera?" And I said, "Fine." And in that sense, it was like most of the experiences I had in China. I moved to Beijing straight out of undergraduate school, partially because I felt connected to China and partially because in my undergraduate panic about surviving in the real world, I had no idea what to do. My dad, who many of you know, is a China scholar, so I had spent my entire childhood summers on overnight train rides across internal China, sleeping in military guest houses in the beds of revolutionary heroes and trekking up holy mountains. You know, when I was 11, I have a very happy for me memory of China, which is when I was 11, we climbed down the staircase over the giant Buddha in Leshan, which is 230 feet tall, carved into the side of a cliff. And I remember looking back up at him from the bottom of the staircase, and each of his limbs was, you know, 1,000 times the size of my entire family. And then back up at the parking lot, there was a micro carver, an artist who was carving Chinese characters into strands of human hair. So, I mean, put simply, China, for me, has always held the possibilities for what's biggest and smallest in the world, and it gave me an image of myself in the world. So in a way, it was no surprise that the first real perspective I got on America and on my own Americanness came from China, or that it was in China in my early 20s that it occurred to me that what I considered to be American actually mattered less than what 1.6 billion other people thought, even if, by my standards, my version of America was more accurate. And for one thing, there's the obvious possibility, which is that my version wasn't actually more accurate. And for another, if 1.6 billion people share ideas about America, then they're important ideas, regardless of whether they conflict with America's own self-perceptions. So at 21, in my desperate search for an adult life, I had taken on a job as a PR executive, one for which I was grossly unqualified. And it required me to write press releases about how American donuts and washing machines were going to improve the quality of life for all Chinese. I struggled with corporate spins. And then suddenly, in between CEO speeches and ribbon-cutting ceremonies, I was filming an exotic fantasy TV drama. Except in this version, as in the new version of my own life, I was the exotic other, which for a middle-class American white girl from Ann Arbor was a kind of revelation. As was my lesson in the expression drop trow, which is my favorite China story, and with which it's the anecdote with which I begin Foreign Babes in Beijing, because it was such a crystallizing language lesson for me. And most of the most symbolically and literally powerful moments in my China life were language lessons. I used to think, when I first moved to China, somewhat optimistically, that cultures were contained in their languages, and that the most you could ever hope to know about someone else's culture was what you would get from speaking his or her language fluently. I still think that that's true, but I have a more realistic spin on it these days. And perhaps because my undergraduate textbook, Helen and David Go to China, this is the Columbia University textbook, didn't cover such vocabulary, when director Yao said, "Okay, now talk who," I had to look it up. I was, at that moment, perched on the edge of a bed in Beijing's five-star Great Wall Sheraton Hotel, thumbing through my red laminated Chinese dictionary, which looked suspiciously like a Mao primer from the Cultural Revolution. So I found the pinyin, the romanization, and pieced it together, tuo, which is peel off, and ku, which is kudza for pants. So I tried to remember how I'd arrived at that moment and wondered whether peel your pants off could mean something other than peel your pants off. And then I turned to Wang Ling as if he might be able to help, and he grinned and started on his belt buckle. Wang Ling played my love interest in Foreign Babes in Beijing. He was unstoppably macho, 6'2", and chiseled, designed by producers and personal trainers to turn the tables on Hollywood stereotypes of wimpy Chinese men, Charlie Chans, inscrutable Orientals, and Asian houseboys. My role was to play the exotic, mysterious femme fatale, relieving Eastern women momentarily of that chore. Jointly, Wang Ling and I, or our characters, were supposed to establish a contemporary counterpoint to a tense historical reality, which is that intercultural romances in China were primarily between Western men and Chinese women. In the 1990s, when I was filming Foreign Babes in Beijing, there were 106.6 males for every 100 females born. That statistic now is someplace up near 120 or 121. The official figure, I think, is 117, but the Chinese Society, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences says it's 120. So you can see why nobody in China likes to see beautiful marriage prospects plucked from the pool, and why China's happy to spare some of its most strapping men to foreign women. Needless to say, Chinese producers wouldn't have dared depict a Chinese woman seducing a Western man on TV, and they still won't. It's much safer to depict China penetrating the West. In the world of Foreign Babes, interestingly, America was responsive to its position in this metaphor. And American women, ever the importers of liberation and libido, were both aggressive and receptive. Jessie's first line of dialogue on that bed was, "I love you, what are we waiting for?" And in this line, she hurled her Westernness at Tianming. He and the audience would instantly understand her lacerating style of seduction and disregard for the sanctity of marriage as typically American. When director Yao told us to talk who, Wang Ling watched me look the words up and then laughed and dropped his pants to the floor. Under normal circumstances, incidentally, I'd have thought he was totally fabulous, but I was panicked under the hot lights. My hair had fallen out of the preposterous updo the makeup team had managed, and Wang Ling politely pushed some of it back from my face. I took the hair clip out and let the rest fall down. You know, in ancient Chinese literature, the removal of hairpins or jewelry signified that a woman was guilty of a sin or crime and awaited punishment. I set my hairpins on the table, and Wang Ling asked me, "Are you embarrassed?" And I said no, even though I was desperately embarrassed, because I wanted to save face. I didn't want Wang Ling to think I was inexperienced in love or TV. So I prepared myself for our first illicit kiss. Wang Ling craned his neck down to kiss me, but director Yao shouted, "Roll around on the bed." I paused to consider what that might mean, but before I could ask, Wang Ling opened his mouth as wide as a gate and stretched it over my head. "No laughing," said director Yao, and then rub his back. So I rubbed his back, and there was a hideously awkward silence in the room, and I wondered if it was just a really exciting scene for everyone. And now I know that they were just astonished, wondering whether Western girls just do it like that. Because, as it turns out, I was supposed to be writhing in ecstasy, but I had missed a vocabulary clue and given a chaste back rub. So Director Yao said, "Caught," and the makeup artists rushed over to repair my lips with a toolkit of lipsticks. "You know," I said, "I'd be more comfortable if Director Yao were also naked." Wang Ling inhaled sharply, the lip gloss brush retracted. And at the time, I thought it was a request born of desperation. But in fact, later, when I tried to convince everyone on the set and then all my friends that Jesse and I were not, in fact, the same person and that neither of us represented all Americans, I regretted asking Director Yao to toi his coup. At the moment, though, it worked because everyone's focus shifted to him, and he said, "We're all professionals here," and in a gesture of tremendous camaraderie and allegiance, he unbuckled his pants and dropped them to the floor. So I thanked him, and we started the scene again, and then as soon as he said action, I tried to redeem myself by vigorously clawing Wang Ling's back, and I overheard the AD whisper to the DP, "See what I mean? Foreign babes are tigers." I, of course, had always thought that that was a stereotype of Eastern women. So after Foreign Babes in Beijing ran on TV, I saw it for the first time. I am embarrassed to confess. And it's so naive that it sounds disingenuous, but the reality is I hadn't actually read the script in advance because my Chinese reading wasn't that good. And so it wasn't until I watched it on TV with everybody else in China that I started to sort out some of the moral messages of the show. The Western press was simultaneously sorting them out and was totally hysterical about what they called Jesse's debaucherous lifestyle. The Hong Kong Standard ran a full-page picture of me under which they had the caption, "Super bitch." Tired of the predictable fare, Chinese viewers are switching on to the debaucherous lifestyle of Rachel Dawoskin's character. The International Herald Tribune printed a story called "Not a Pretty Picture, Foreign Babes in Beijing," under which they ran a smiley picture of me in front of a bust of Mao. The London Times wrote, "Chinese feed their fear of foreigners," using the same bust of Mao picture and juxtaposing it to one of a Chinese soldier in Tiananmen Square. And the Washington Post followed suit with my all-time favorite headline, "Neo-nationalistic China, suspect of Western ways, embraces foreign babes." The concern was, of course, that Foreign Babes was a propaganda machine, that it was anti-Western. But as far as I could tell, after reading it quite carefully all night, every night when I couldn't sleep, none of the coverage actually had that much to do with the truth. I mean, there was the obvious gaffe, which was that it didn't include the fiber of our days, which were all about kind of no heat on the set, a totally unglamorous lifestyle, you know, fatty meat lunchboxes three times a day, and our conversations, which were about matters of daily life and reality, you know, food, movies, books, sex, the regular. They were not about cross-cultural issues or self-referential cheesy crises of identity. But the main thing, to my mind, that the press missed was that the Foreign Babes were redeemed in the show. That while Foreign Babes pretended to be a moral drama, it was actually less a warning than an advertisement. And this is still true, if you turn on the TV in China, of anything other than the drabbest state-run fare. The way I saw it, there were three versions of Foreign Babes in Beijing. There was the show the censors saw, which was a kind of light drama. Then there was the show the censors said they saw, which was an educational model with strong moral implications. And then the third one was the show the Chinese audience saw, which was a hot depiction of interracial sex, Western wealth, and success. And unlike true propaganda, which provides answers, Babes, I think, raised questions. So in keeping with the history of Chinese literature and politics, it braved the danger of all kind of tempt and teach literature, which is that audiences will be absorbed by the sexuality and miss the teach part. So for example, the lurid exploration of lascivious acts in Buddhist morality tales, and therefore lose sight of the moral message. So Foreign Babes in Beijing, in a sense, just spoke an old risky language in a new risky way. Right after, this is as evidence, right after the show aired on Chinese TV, teenage girls started following me through marketplaces and buying whatever I bought, whether it was like extension cords or fish paste. I was always buying esoteric components and condiments in China. Like, that's kind of how I spent my weekends. One time I bought a fake Prada purse, and I could hear the women behind me saying, you know, "American girls love Prada purses," and snatching them up. So, I mean, one takeaway from this was that even my real life became ultimately a surreal advertisement. But the other takeaway was that decades of propaganda hadn't been without effect. And this is still true, that the Chinese audience is full of wary consumers of moral drama who recognize the hackneyed tropes of propaganda, and their appetite for something more flavorful remains intact. And the more flavorful fare now is, of course, reality TV. Shows like Chinese versions of American Idol and things, which I'll talk about in a minute. I've spent a lot of time watching those shows. As for foreign babes, you know, in contrast to the usual cliches, the liminal Jesse and Louisa were outsiders who existed within Chinese culture, separate from sort of Japanese-style invaders or Western-style opium traders of old propaganda. And Jesse and Louisa were offering up kind of products. Hard currency, the freedom to travel, liberated sex, international business opportunities, and air-conditioned condominiums. And to me, the question isn't really whether such girls are good or bad, but whether the pleasures they offer can be enjoyed without compromising China's cultural attainment. It wasn't only the audience also who forgave the foreign babes for their flirty Western indiscretions. The producers and the plot forgave them too. In the end of Foreign Babes in Beijing, when Jesse disregards her American parents, who, unlike my parents, are racist patriots, and threaten to disown her if she marries a lazy, uncultured Chinese guy, but who speak fluent Chinese on the phone with her, she chooses China over America and love over money in a very direct way. She says at some point to Tianming's mother, "I don't love money, I love Tianming." But I found that an interesting and funny kind of sacrifice, because true love didn't really used to be the goal exactly in China. I mean, if you consider Cultural Revolution ideology, any personal feeling was supposed to be converted into a passion to serve the state. So by making a sacrifice with true love as the end goal, foreign babes shrunk tacky political baggage to fit tacky commercial appetites. But in the final scene of Foreign Babes, Jesse and Tianming leave for their glistening life in America, and it's a scene of inevitable exodus. It's not a scene of sort of xenophobic misery. And it suggests the sort of natural progression. They're birds flying overhead, and, you know, in a way, it's an ideal end to the story. The good girl marries the brother. Jesse, the bad girl, marries Tianming. And one couple, one interracial couple, goes west, and the other stays in China to Yanglao, or cultivate the parents in their dotage. But Western women, in general, are the subjects and objects of interest and attention in China. Western men, the objects, I think, of hostility and resentment, likely the result of centuries of barbarian invasions. When I lived in Beijing, if you were a Western woman dancing with a Chinese guy in a nightclub, people cheered for you. Sometimes I would get into cabs with Chinese guy friends, and the cab driver would congratulate the guy. But if you were a Western man dancing with a Chinese woman, people broke beer bottles over your head. And I think, you know, today, 10 years later, there's a much greater degree of familiarity between expatriates and locals in every city in China, at least the ones I frequent. But the dynamics remain basically the same, I would say. Most of what Western women experience there is a kind of celebration. And as for the stereotypes of foreign women in China, which include things like that we're kaifang or open-minded, which I always took to be a compliment, but actually means we're promiscuous and loose-moraled, and that we're kind of importers of spiritual pollution, those ideas do not originate in the Chinese imagination. They are American imports. My feeling about it is, if the only American woman you've ever had contact with is Pamela Anderson on Baywatch, you may think that American women are sluts. When I griped to the customers back in the day about foreign babes in Beijing, when they gave me this enormous hair and fur coats like sewn together so that they dragged behind me in a train, I said, you know, I'm playing a foreign exchange student. There's just no way I would be wearing rhinestone jewelry. And they said, we don't care what you think. This is what the Chinese audience wants to see. And besides, you look like Dallas. I was like, you've seen Dallas? So in 2005, China ran its first mega hit version of American Idol, which was called Mongolian Cow Sour Sour Yogurt Supergirl Voice, which is now conveniently called Supergirl. And 400 million people watched it, and millions of them voted, and the girl they chose as the winner, the biggest winner of all time of that show, which has now run several times, was a spiky-haired, androgynous tomboy of a 23-year-old girl. And I thought that she was a very tough and interesting choice, and she, to me, suggested that Chinese girls do not aspire to be delicate or understated. They did not have those aspirations in the 1990s when Foreign Babes ran, and they do not have those aspirations now. You know, nobody wanted to be Saoza, the weeping, virtuous, scorned heroine of Foreign Babes in Beijing. So, of course, there was severe official criticism of Supergirl, accusing the show of promoting vulgarity and discouraging youngsters from living life practically with realistic expectations. Government officials argued that it reflected disintegrating moral and social values and that allowing citizens to vote could lead to unwanted political pressures. So the following year, the government agency in charge of radio, film, and TV issued a list of edicts about reality TV contests, including that there be no gossip about the contestants, no scenes of fans screaming and wailing, and no losing contestants in tears. And finally, that the show be recast. So it's now an all-male singing competition called, in Chinese, Happy Boy Voice. But I have to say that having watched it carefully last summer, excluding women has not successfully reduced the level of hysteria on or about the show. And the star of the show is still a woman named Yang Archinamu, a controversial lightning rod of a female judge. She's kind of China's Paula Abdul. She's famous for her 8 kiss and tell books about growing up in Mosuo culture, which is matrilineal society that practices female polygamy. And she's a hugely independent and unapologetic liberated feminist who writes these scandalous books. And Chinese audiences love her and hate her and love to hate her. And she's a huge scandal. And there's no mistake in why the producers cast her for the show. I mean, they knew. Which is that, to me, the reason that Chinese audiences love her is the same reason that they loved Jesse, which is that they want to have agency. People in China want to be tough and powerful, to have choices and get what they strive for, including women. And I'm going to wrap up with a story of my best Chinese friend, who's my age, a Beijinger named Anna, who in the 1990s, when I was living in Beijing, fell in love with a Saudi Arabian student named Khalid. And needless to say, nobody approved. His embassy forbade its scholarship students to date Chinese women. And Anna's parents were furious and bewildered that she had a foreign boyfriend. But Anna and Khalid ignored the rules in honor of love to hear her tell the story. And they were traveling in Kunming when security guards broke into their hotel room in the middle of the night one night. Foreigners and Chinese were not allowed to travel together back in the day. And the hotel reported them to their university. So Anna did self-criticisms for 7 months until she graduated. And because she had a bad attitude about those self-criticisms, she refused to admit that she and Khalid had a romance. She kept demanding that she was his tour guide. The university security department produced a poster detailing her story with a picture of her, and they hung it on campus. Her family saw it because they lived nearby. But all Anna would ever say to me of the scorn and the humiliation associated with this experience was that she was sorry that Khalid had to endure it. Because she said that as a Chinese person, she was innately trained to absorb and expect such treatment, but that the authorities shouldn't embarrass or insult foreign students. To my mind, the cost to Khalid was slight, whereas the cost to Anna was quite severe. But she braved the odds and kept living with him until he returned to the Middle East, after which she wrote him a letter every day for 2 years. He never wrote back because he was a diplomat and wasn't allowed to write to Chinese girls. When I asked Anna why she kept writing him, she said she wanted to marry him. And then one day in 1995, he appeared back in Beijing to polish his Chinese after more than 2 years at home, during which time he had married a Saudi Arabian woman in an arranged marriage. He called Anna right away to say he wanted to see her. Anna was worried, and she said, "I might not like him because now he was a successful career and a failed personality." She and I had a kind of free trade language arrangement, and we did not correct each other's sentences. And she introduced us anyway at a place called Uncle Sam's Fast Food. For those of you who are familiar with Beijing, it's over by Sight Tower. I don't recommend it. We were unwrapping hamburgers when he walked in, and he was handsome and quite grown-up looking. And Anna fluttered around talking. She said, "You know, his Chinese is excellent." She was using Chinese herself. And I said, "It's nice to meet you," in English, because I think, I always feel it's patronizing and kind of show-offy to use your non-native language in a conversation in which you have a choice. But of course, Khalid didn't speak English, so I came off as an ugly American for the assumption. We only Chinese in common, and his was better than mine, and there was nothing else I could imagine bringing up. So I said, "Your Chinese is impressive," and he said, "So is yours," and we did that over and over for about 5 minutes. And then we all looked around the restaurant, and I tried to picture them knowing each other, remembered a photo album that Anna had showed me. She kept it at work, actually. It was full of cheesecake pictures of her posing on bridges and under pagodas. Khalid had taken them all, she told me, and they spanned the seasons. It's kind of Anna on ice skates on Hohai, under trees with orange leaves, in a bathing suit at the Beidaiha seashore. So all of a sudden, I said to him, "What's it like being married?" And he said, "Good." And I said, "What's married life like for your wife?" And he smiled at me, and he said, "My wife's life is better than the lives of women in other countries." And I said, "How do you figure that?" And Khalid said, if you're a woman in Saudi Arabia, no one disrespects you on the streets. If you're in trouble and men stop to help you, you know they will help you. Whereas in other countries, I asked him. You must know the answer to that, he said. In America, if you stop on the street and need help from a man, he's likely to attack you, rape you even. I said, that's ludicrous. No one who stops to help you in the U.S. is likely to attack you. And why does on the street matter so much? What about in your own house or in schools or in professional circles? Khalid said, in Saudi Arabia, there's no chance of violence against women. Men there respect our women and would never hurt them. They're untouchable. Of course, I didn't know Chinese for untouchable, so Anna had to translate it. But there was no doubt that the last word belonged to Khalid. We did not touch the subject of women in China, even though I wanted to. I wanted to fight. But Anna stood up suddenly and said, we have to get back to the office. And Khalid and I shook hands again, and that was it. That's the only time I ever met him. Anna and I had a conversation that night after work in which she stated plainly, it was awkward with you and Khalid today. You were unsuitable for each other. Maybe because your cultures are so different. I asked if their cultures weren't different as well, and she said she guessed they were. And then as evidence, she said that Khalid's new wife had to sit in the back of the house with a cloth over her face whenever men came to play cards 5 nights a week. I expressed surprise that he wasn't busier with matters of the state, and Anna said, this is a terrible question, but do you think his wife is pretty? And I said, I have no idea. And she said, I can't believe he's married to this arranged girl. It's such a waste. And when I asked her what she meant by such a waste, she said, if she has to wear a cloth over her face anyway, then why couldn't she have been Chinese? Okay. So I will happily take your questions. Yeah.
Does the government regulate or interfere in any way with producing shows of that kind?
Does the government interfere with or regulate production of TV shows? The government is in complete control of the production of TV shows, I would say. I mean, there are now, you know, locally produced television shows, but the answer is a resounding yes. The censorship process is still quite lively. And, you know, it's somewhat successful and somewhat unsuccessful. I spent last summer writing an article for the Sunday Times of London about Superboy, the Happy Boy Voice. Actually, one of the edicts which was issued by the government after the Supergirl hysteria was that the title of the show could no longer include the word super. I think maybe because it suggests the American Superman, maybe because it hints at a kind of desire to reach up above the masses that's unseemly. But, of course, everybody refers to the show in English as Superboy. So in a way, SARFT, the Radio, Film, and TV Bureau, they're not in control exactly anymore. They try to be. There's a conversation happening between SARFT and producers, but there's tremendous amount of appetite for very, very commercial productions like American Idol, and they are happening, and you can see them on TV. And I don't think they have sound socialist moral messages.
Yeah.
Is your show playing in reruns currently?
The question is Foreign Babes in Beijing playing in reruns currently? When I was there last summer, somebody told me that it was playing in Hunan. I've not seen it myself, so I can't vouch. It played in reruns for a very long time after it first ran in 1996. It was still playing when I left in 2000. But I'm not sure, actually. I hope not. I really hope not. Yeah.
What's your next book about?
What's my next book about? My next book is a novel, and it's about an ESL teacher in New York who marries her Chinese student after the 1989 Tiananmen incident in Beijing. It's about their marriage.
Yes.
You mentioned the phrase soap opera. Do they really use that phrase there as a description of the program? And do they know why it was ever called a soap opera here?
The question is, do they use the term soap opera, and do they know why it was called soap opera here? Actually, it's something of a misnomer even to call it a soap opera, because it's not, as soaps are in the U.S., it's not filmed and aired simultaneously. And it's not filmed and aired simultaneously because that prevents them from censoring it as aggressively as they like to. So it's more, actually, it's closer to call it a mini-series in the sense that, we filmed it for 6 months and then it aired, you know, for 60 years. But it was just a continuous loop. There are no new episodes. So it's not actually really a soap opera. It was in the can, and so that way they can censor it at every level. They censor the scripts, and then after each episode is produced, they censor each episode individually, and then they look at the whole thing and they censor it a third time, and then they put it on the air. Yes, and then yes, sorry.
On that video clip that you showed, they had your character spoken part dubbed.
Yes.
Was your character dubbed the entire time or just for that opening part?
No, it was dubbed the entire time. I didn't do my own voiceover work because I could not, I frankly couldn't do another 6 months in the studio. I had to go back to my other job. And none of the Chinese actors did their own voice work either because it wasn't considered glamorous. Nobody was interested in doing voiceover work. Now most Chinese shows have simultaneous sound. Simultaneous sound is just more expensive. It's just a low-budget production thing to do a dubbing later. But nobody on the show did his or her own sound, or maybe a couple of the older actors did, but none of us did our own voices. And I was hysterical. I mean, when I watched that for the first time and heard my voice, you can imagine I was apoplectic. And the woman who did my voice speaks beautiful Chinese. It's an American woman named Jean Jones, whom I love and admire. And she, in fact, played our mom in the show, even though she was 40. How dare they? But she did my voice, and she affected this adorable, high-pitched foreign babe accent. I was stunned. I didn't hear it until the entire thing was on air again, because I just didn't go to the studio to listen in. But yeah, the whole thing was dubbed. And I worked really hard to get the dialogue right, too, which was another killer. I felt like if they were going to dub it, I didn't understand how it was working as we filmed, so I didn't know they were dubbing it. And I every day I met my tutor for hours preceding our filming so I would get the dialogue right because I didn't want to humiliate Americans. You can thank me after the talk for saving face. Yeah.
Rachel, I just recently completed reading a book on China. It's called Chinese Lessons by John Pomfret.
Right.
I don't know whether you're familiar with him. He's a journalist with the Washington Post. Amongst other things, one of the things that he mentioned was that there is a high rate of corruption in China, and it's a case of who you know that will enable you to get things done.
Right.
To what extent is that correct?
Right. She brings up John Pomfret's book. John Pomfret was a journalist in China with the Washington Post when I was there, and actually a good friend of mine. Right, I know John well, and I admire his book. He talks about corruption in his book, and the question is, to what extent is it true that corruption in China is the law of the land and you have to know somebody to get something? My feeling about it is no more or less than here. I mean, I think, you know, if you ask somebody at Halliburton, for example, whether knowing somebody in high places helps you make money, he'll say yes. There's a lot of corruption in the Chinese government. There's a lot of corruption here. And in terms of knowing people, nepotism, trying to get a job in China, it's friendlier in a way, I would say. Like, it's easier to call. If you're a foreigner living in China, especially, if you call an office to try to get a job or to try to get an interview, often you'll get the president of the office on the phone directly. It's a much smaller community and a smaller world. As for government corruption, you know, I think that problem is rampant in a lot of places, and America is the first one I would look at.
You mentioned something about censorship. Do you know if Foreign Babes in Beijing was censored in any way?
The question is, was Foreign Babes in Beijing censored in any way? I hounded the producers. I was dying to know the answer to that question. I wanted to know what the scripts had looked like originally, what they look like now, which lines were being cut, why. I could never find out anything about it. It was not a conversation that they wanted to have with us. And I can see why. We had one fight ourselves, Sophie and I, the girl who played the good girl, which was about AIDS. There was a conversation about AIDS in Foreign Babes in Beijing, which implied that you could get AIDS from used clothing, primarily from used clothing that was imported from the West. And we had a fit about that and said, you know, we were going to quit the show. We did a whole melodramatic thing. And they said, you know, usually actors don't have a say in this sort of thing. And we said, but it hurts the feelings of our home countries. And they cut the line. They did not cut the scene. There was a scene mysteriously close to the one that they said they would cut when I watched it. But the actual line, the actual dialogue about the AIDS-infected clothing never made it to the show. So we felt that was a small victory. What they cut, I'll never know. I'd be interested to know. You know, a lot of my friends there now are filmmakers. And it's often not the thing that you would expect. The stuff that gets cut is sort of about sensibility. One of my friends made a movie which he wanted to call Modern Woman, and the censors hated the title Modern Woman, and they made him change it. And he asked why, because it was not a particularly contentious or politically loaded title. And they said, we just don't think it fits the movie at all. It doesn't fit the look of the movie. So It's not always clear. I think sometimes it's literally a question of the personal taste of the person assigned your project. Yeah.
Who's playing me in the Paramount picture?
Who's playing me in the Paramount picture? The short answer is I don't really know. Nobody has signed a contract yet. There's chat about it. There's rumors about it. I know that they're talking to Natalie Portman, and that she's been said to be attached, but that doesn't mean that she signed a contract. So I'm not 100% sure. These movie things happen slowly and rockily, I would say. But they like her, and I like her. She's a smart Jewish girl from Long Island. You know? Seems about right. Yeah.
Are you rich and famous?
Am I rich and famous? No. Not really. But thank you for asking. Yeah.
When you were in China, did you get paid in proportion to the success of the show?
I got paid in proportion to my talent, I would say. So the way that worked was I made $80 an episode. And there were 21 episodes. I made about $2,000 for the entire show. And I actually found that poetic and hilarious because in my corporate job, I was paid obscenely. Incidentally, I was also entirely unqualified for my corporate job. But they wildly overpaid me and gave me an enormous living stipend ultimately. And I was paid significantly more than my Chinese colleagues who were way more capable than I was. And it was a constant source of embarrassment for me. And glee for them. I mean, my colleagues found it funny that I was so overpaid because they could see that I was just, gasping for air right at the level about to go underwater all the time. And when I found out how underpaid I was on the set of Foreign Babes, I had a rollicking laugh about it with my co-star, Wang Ling, who was not underpaid. I think the Chinese actors made, $20,000, $30,000. They made some reasonable kind of TV rate for having done professional acting work. And let me just say, you get what you pay for. Because you may notice that things like when the Foreign Babes stood up, it looked like sort of spastic marionettes being yanked from above. And when the Chinese actors stood up, they looked like professional actors doing a dance move they had learned at Juilliard. So it was worth $20,000 for them and $80 an episode for us, I would say. Other questions? Yeah.
How would you compare the journalistic freedom in Hong Kong versus Beijing or Shanghai?
How would I compare the journalistic freedom in Hong Kong versus Beijing or Shanghai? I think probably, I'm embarrassed to answer these hardcore China questions in front of my dad, who has better answers for all of them. Maybe we'll come back to your corruption question in a minute and ask Ken to weigh in. But I think there's less of a difference now than there was, pre-1997 when Hong Kong went back to Chinese rule. I mean, if you look at a paper like the Hong Kong Standard, it looks a lot more now like the China Daily than it did back in the day or than it now does the IHT. But I don't know, Dan? Yeah? What about corruption? Halliburton? There are a lot of China scholars in the audience. Yeah.
How much has the Chinese film industry improved in recent years? And also, follow up on her question, you talk about speaking Chinese and Chinese culture. I imagine you're just talking about around the greater Beijing area, but that would also have a lot of influx of people from other parts of China, which I imagine would be quite different. It would be like saying people from Europe.
You mean different dialects? Are we talking about...
Yes, different dialects, just different ways of acting. True, people in China aren't as monolithic as America once was. I'm sure they're quite different.
Oh, that's definitely true. I mean, there are many, many languages spoken in China. I speak only Mandarin. And Mandarin, almost anywhere you go, you can survive if you have Mandarin. People speak a little bit of it, even in places where it's not, widely spoken or the only language spoken. The Chinese film industry is thriving and very interesting. I don't know as much about it as I did back in the day when I lived there. But I think it's, most of the films I watch are sort of gritty, low-budget, underground films. And then I watch the big-budget Chinese films that come to Hollywood now. And I like them. I like Chinese movies tremendously. I like this guy who made Blind Shaft. You guys see that movie? It's a very interesting movie about miners in China. My all-time favorite movie is a very old, which is, and it's an early Zhang Yimou movie, The Story of Choju, which is about this peasant woman whose husband gets kicked, embarrassingly kicked, by the village chief. Mm-hmm. And she goes through every level of government trying, all she wants is an apology. And I used to, when I had a corporate job in Beijing, I used to tell Western executives, if they wanted to understand how the legal system worked in China, they should watch The Story of Choju, because it was a kind of survey course in every level of government, from the smallest local authorities to the central government, and how to get things done there, or how to try really valiantly to get things done there. It's a very charming movie.
Rachel? Thank you very much.
Thank you guys very much for having me.
This concludes our broadcast. For a complete listing of upcoming events at the Ann Arbor District Library, visit our website at www.aadl.org or call the library at 734-327-4200. Press option 3 for events listings.